Hello, I'm Jack Stilgo from UCL's Department of Science and Technology Studies, and I'm here for another of the UCL Science Policy podcasts. And today I'm joined by Professor John Butterworth, who is head of physics at UCL and is involved in various policy discussions. John, I wanted to ask you first about the issue of science funding, because I think what we see in the world of science policy is a move more and more to a political focus on short-term impact of science and research. And you work in one of these areas where I guess it's harder to make that case. You know, you're involved with the Large Hadron Collider and things at CERN. So how have you found engaging with those sorts of discussions?
I think it's maybe not quite fair to say that the government's driving more towards short-term, actually. I mean, on the ground, it feels like that sometimes, and maybe some of the implementations. But I mean, for instance, last night, the Science Museum opened their exhibit on CERN, and George Osborne was there, and he made a speech where he talked about the benefits of curiosity-led research and stable funding, which is, you know, it's good to hear from the Chancellor of the Exchequer. I mean, it's certainly true that people tie themselves in knots a little sometimes about the impact agenda in the research evaluation framework and things, but even there, for instance, we've submitted an impact case study based on the Higgs because of the inspirational value it has. Not even, you could have submitted one on the technological spin-offs as well, but this one is just about the cultural and educational impact it has. And we've got, you know, people from major media organisations to say how the Higgs story stimulates their figures, their sales and things. So it's, I think we're in, actually in the UK, we're in quite a good situation. The language that's being taught by the government, it clearly does a utilitarian agenda that in the end someone like George Osborne is fund, or you know, governments in general fund science because there's, it's at very least economically sustainable and is providing therefore some economic benefit. But I think we have there are people there who understand the language of the inspirational value of finding out how the universe works, and they also understand the long-term requirements of that. I mean, the fact that CERN has been funded stably by a consortium of European governments since 1954 is the reason it's now the best place to do this science. Mm. It's not so much about the absolute level of funding, it's about the stability and the planning. And for a long-term vision like working out the basic building blocks of nature, or for providing major technical capabilities, like for instance the neutron or neutron beams and light sources that we have in Oxfordshire in the UK, those require long-term planning and a long-term vision.
So have you and colleagues got better at making the case for your funding, or is that something that actually in the world of particle physics has always had to be done?
I think we've got better. I think there's been a massive cultural change within the subject over my career. I remember as a PhD student being told, we better get out there and start talking to people. We can no longer assume we have a right to exist, you know, as a well-funded area of science. And we were encouraged then to get more into policy engagement and public engagement. So things like MP pairing schemes and also talking to the media and just going talking to schools and those things suddenly became, actually, if we want particle physics to survive, we need the consent of the people who pay the bill. And it's not enough to lobby behind the scenes in Whitehall. And in fact, you really saw the difference with that. You would very often get a civil servant, senior civil servant would say, you know, keep your head down, don't make a fuss. We know this is valuable, but the moment it gets into the wider public domain, you won't get any support because the public don't understand what you're doing. Only we understand what you're doing. And now with the Large Hadron Collider and when CERN opened its doors for the switch on, the public response was overwhelmingly positive, even though it broke 9 days later.
Yeah.
And I think that's moved the game on a lot, and hopefully not just for particle physics. I think that the public have rewarded a certain amount of trust that maybe the politicians and the media were taken aback actually by how positive the response was, I think.
Mm. And I think it's that there is some survey evidence actually that members of the public do support the idea of curiosity-driven basic science more than politicians sometimes give them credit
for. I think that's right, yeah. I mean, obviously, when it comes to the level of, you know, how much money would one spend, but the public generally, overestimate what they think they're spending on it. They think the budget is bigger than it really is, and they still support that budget. So yeah, I think in Britain we looked on. Certainly my European and US colleagues, they look at Britain and think that we've done something really quite good there. That we have a population that is understanding and tolerant and excited by some of the basic science questions that are addressed, not just in particle physics,
there is a size of cake for money to be spent on basic science, and there are also questions about, well, how should that cake be divided up? And there are some voices, I mean, Dave King and others, that say that actually we're facing quite a lot of pressing problems, and actually particle physics seems like a bit of a luxury.
Yeah, I certainly David chose switch on of the LHC to tell everyone that.
Yes,
I think he's wrong. I mean, I think that there's a place for application and problem led research in the sense of trying to sort out how to provide cheaper energy or something, and looking for solutions there, or having to manage and predict and deal with climate change, for instance. And obviously medical research is a huge one there as well. But it needs to be in part of an ecosystem where we are just where we also have some fraction of our energies and time that is spent just working out how the world works. I often feel a little sorry for some of my colleagues in the life sciences, because in a way, it's great. Their impact is so obvious, and that they're going to cure cancer, or they're going to. And there are many people working very hard on very specific applications of that. On the other hand, sitting down and just working out how cells divide and how life starts and what that is a brilliant fundamental question, as fundamental at least as finding the Higgs boson, which, to my view, should receive funding because it's interesting, whether or not it cures cancer. And it does at some level, but I think the battle lines are much closer drawn there, and they're within the field, whereas particle physics, at some level, we hold our hands up and say, okay, you can have the World Wide Web and you can have superconducting cables and that, but really what we're doing is basically useless. We're only doing it because we want to find out how the universe works.
And you can get on and do it.
And then we can get on. Once we win the argument once, then we don't have the continual pressure from then on. Whereas if you're in a much more applied but equally interesting area, then the pressure can be every grant round or every publication, or you know, it can be much more intimate and tense, I think, that kind of tension in the field.
Great. Now there's another area of on this same sort of line about how science is done that you've been pretty closely involved in, which is, I think, a really important policy topic right now, which is the question of open access to scientific data and downstream open access to scientific publications. I mean, what's your involvement been in that issue, and what do you think the sides of that debate are?
Well, my involvement has been essentially as a very interested observer, but also via I was on the STFC's science board when this was all, as an advisory body, when all this was being brought in. So we had some discussions about how the government's desire to make sure, initially at least, that taxpayer-funded research is available free without you having to pay a paywall to a journal to get it when you've already paid for it once as a taxpayer, which I think is absolutely correct, but the implementations of this can be very problematic. So, and obviously I publish papers, so I'm interested anyway. But this goes right to the heart of the nature of science, and I think in that sense it's a very important principle. It's absolutely correct, not just that the papers are publicly accessible, but in principle at least the data is publicly accessible, because that's the only way you can reproduce results. It's one of the best ways of stopping fraud in science, which, you know, does happen, and it's a way of checking for mistakes. I mean, in the end, many eyes find problems. Open source code works because anyone can see if there's a bug in there, anyone can see it, and at some level that's what science is like. You should be able to look at the data and see if you agree that the analysis was done right, and if the especially if the data has been taxpayer funded. But I think it also, you know, when we approve a drug for use by the NHS, we should be able to see all the data from the trials that show that drug is useful and going to do more good than harm, and is worth the money. And that's not true. It's astonishing that there are drugs being paid for by the National Health Service where the evidence that they work is not public. I think that's absolutely shameful, and it's not the way science works, really. It leaves it open to all kinds of of problems, not either malicious or error, malicious misrepresentation of data or errors in the data. So I think that aspect of open access is absolutely brilliant, that somehow the Research Council's the UK government has got that. I think internationally, actually, many funding bodies and governments get that now, and I hope that works. On the other hand, I think that the way it's been implemented has been kind of sort of hijacked a little by the publishers, who, of course, got a lot to lose when it comes to the papers. In particle physics, since even before we invented the World Wide Web, there was a mailing list called the Archive, run by Los Alamos initially, that all the theorists used to send their particle theorists used to send their papers to it, and it would be mailed round. And then, of course, when the web came, it became a web page, and it's there. And all experimental particle physicists do that now. All astronomers, astrophysicists do it, and a big chunk of the rest of physics does it, and maths as well now. And that there's no embargo period. You put your thing up there the moment you send it to the journal at the same time, and you start getting comments and from your peers, and they start reading it and citing it or rubbishing it if it's rubbish. Right from the probably 2 months before it's published in some cases, and in the end the publishing peer review stage is just a stamp of approval that you weren't just that this wasn't some crazy piece of nonsense that no one ever should have wasted their time on.
The publishers must hate it though.
Yeah, I guess so. Mm. I mean, there's a danger now, you know, that some of the and I remember when I published my first paper, there was some form that said, you know, you've not got to put this anywhere else. It's copyright, blah blah blah. And the guy, the theorist, the senior guy who was writing a paper with me, I said, what do we do about this? Oh, ignore it. It's not so we didn't bother. So we put it on the archive, of course. And the publishers, I guess because particle physics is not a big money spinner, they just ignored it and got on with it. There's a real danger now that with this becoming a big agenda, they're going to start enforcing embargo periods. Mm-hmm. Well, I think if they do that, we will. The culture of the archive is so ingrained in particle physics and astronomy now, that people will just stop submitting to the big journals. It doesn't matter if you're in a high-impact journal. If no one can read your paper on the archive, then it won't get cited.
So this is an instance in which the scientific community are already exerting their power over the publishers.
We'll see. I think we already did, and they let us get away with it for a long time. Now it's become now they're under much more threat because of course all of science may go this way, and that really exposes their business model to a lot of problems. So they may come back and try and make trouble for us now, but I think that they've missed the boat in our case, at least in particle physics and astronomy, and I really wish the rest of science would do that as well. I mean, institutional subject-based repositories, we should just put it out there immediately, put the paper out there, and then we update them when they are accepted with the biojournal, assuming they are eventually, then we update with the final version, and that's fine. That's green open access, basically.
But what it does is throw no money in the direction of publishers because it says in effect you're redundant or the services that you provide are rather marginal to the
Right, the distribution function is not needed and hasn't been needed for ages. The archiving function is not needed as long as this thing is funded, and it's just at least as stable as a private publisher as far as I can see. And it's Cornell University who run it now, but they get donations and help from all around the world because everyone uses it. Also means, for instance, third world scientists have access to all this stuff without needing to go and pay an extortionate subscription fee to a journal. So the journals do provide some valuable service, which is the editorial function and managing the peer review is valuable, but is it really worth the amount of money they charge? I think they have to look at their business model there, it's true.
Mm-hmm. And so your sense at the moment is that the UK government has in effect gone down the wrong
I think
track.
What they've done is this Finch report came out saying that what they call gold open access is the way to go, which is where you pay the journal again. So you know, the taxpayer doesn't only pay for doing the research and for the universities to subscribe to the journal. They also pay the journal for the privilege of publishing it so that everyone else can read it, which is just throwing more money at the journals. I think it's just crazy. So I think we should have gone for this public repository idea, which is the green model they call. And I think we will. Internationally, that's what people are doing, basically. And I think, you know, one of the key things will be where the next round of research assessment that goes on after the REF, which we're just finishing with now, I hope, or submitting now anyway. What will that specify? Will it specify that you could only put papers in there if they're open access? It probably will. But the question then is, what will they call open access? Will a public repository, green open access, be okay, or does it have to be some other model? So all that's going on. But I stress it's all about the implementation. The principle is absolutely solid that it's great that this is an agenda item, that people are discussing it, but it's obviously important that we get it right as well.
John Butterworth, thank you very much for coming in today.
Okay, it's a pleasure.